back again. Yes, we're back. As are you, as well, probably, unless you're here for the first time. But welcome, once more, to the House of Hammer, Episode 7. Lucky for some. Well, lucky for you. Particularly if you enjoy nylon stockings and concealed weapons. But frankly, who doesn't? Idiots, that's who. And as we creep around our House of Hammer looking for door number 7, we ponder, where are we now? I don't mean in a metaphysical sense. Nor am I looking for a description like you might get if you entered a new room in the late 80s, early 90s kids TV show Nightmare. You're in a room, there's a wall that looks like a face, and there's a table. Go to the table. Take the bread and the dagger. Or should we take the poison? Don't take that scroll, you fool. Goblin horn, sidestep left! No, I don't mean where are we in that sense. I mean, where are we in the catalogue of all things Hammer? Well, in the last few episodes we've died in high heels. Not literally, but I've always suspected that could be how Adam goes. We've taken a dark road to Blackpool for a non-acting masterclass. And we've bundled 3 Bartons into 1 bumper episode. And whilst we've been doing that, time has cracked on. We began our Hammer Odyssey back in 1935 with the history of the Mary Celeste. And now, with this most recent picture, we've made it as far as 1948. Unbelievable! Before we go any further, I think it's about time we bring you up to speed with how Hammer were getting on in the latter part of the 1940s. And to do just that is Smokey. Just Smokey. Like Liberace. Only prone to even more flamboyant excess.
Well, here we are again, my friends. Time once again for one of Smokey's famous roundups of movie history. I say famous, it's rather more infamous. You know, infamous is when it's more than famous. Anyway, I digress. You may remember long, long ago, back there on episode 1, I gave you all a little backstory on the early days of Hollywood, cinema in general, and of course, the formation of Hammer. Seems so long ago, doesn't it? Episode 1. We seem so young, naive, and nervous. Well, never fear. We have all grown and matured since then. There will certainly be no cynical pop culture grabs like Tiger King and Emmerdale Farm from yours truly this time around. But I digest. During the meanwhilest, we have scampered our way from Mystery of the Mary Celeste in 1935 to 1936's Song of Freedom, and then hopped, skipped and jumped onto 3 Dicks before plunging into the murky, crime-filled waters of this episode's River Patrol. As we've mentioned before, it really has been something of an acid trip journey. Where else would you find your hosts leaping from sea-stranded murder mysteries to Paul Robeson singing in an East End boozer? From a poison-laced curry to possibly the worst acting performance of all time. Huh? No, I'm seriously asking where. I mean, I'm sure on that show, if it does exist, their version of Smokey doesn't put up with the haranguing that I do. But I play chess. Now is not the time to question one's life or friend choices. No, now is the time to have a look through what was happening in the world of the world, and the world of Hammer. Also, bear in mind that this isn't a comprehensive list, it's my list. So, if I miss any of your favourites off, take it on the chin. There's a good boy. Or girl. 1936 saw Frank Capra take home the Best Picture Oscar for Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. Fritz Lang produced his first Hollywood movie, Fury. Shirley Temple was top of the charts of the most bankable stars. And Lionel Barrymore donned a fabulous old lady wig and voice in the wonderful The Devil Doll. 1937 sees the Marx Brothers bring the funny with A Day at the Races. The silent film archives of the Fox Film Corporation are destroyed by a massive vault inferno, and Disney released Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs to massive financial and critical success. Shame, really. Whatever happened to Disney? Don't really hear about anything about them anymore, do you? 1938 sees the Jimmy Stewart picture You Can't Take It With You nab the Oscar for Best Picture. Production begins on a little movie called The Wizard of Oz, and a certain Mr. Vincent Price makes his cinematic debut. 1939, now you're talking. Regarded by some as one of the finest years of movie production, it did not throw out some corkers. Not only do we get Basil Rathbone's introduction as Sherlock Holmes in The Hound of the Baskervilles, we also get Gone with the Wind and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's not too shabby. 1940 is no slouch either. Hitchcock's Rebecca, his first film made in the US, is released. Charlie Chaplin gives us his Great Dictator, and that man Jimmy Stewart cleans up once again with the Philadelphia Story. 1941, nothing much happens at all, oh, except Citizen Kane, the Maltese Falcon, and How Green Was My Valley. Oh, 1942, you have so much to do now. Well, 1942 just wants us to be sad. Not only does the year make Mrs. Miniver the highest grossing film of the entire decade, it also kills Carol Lombard and Bambi's mum. Shame on you, 1942, you heartless beast. 1943 treats us somewhat better, with Casablanca flying high as the year's highest grossing picture, and picking up Best Picture and Best Director Oscars, while For Whom the Bell Tolls did spankingly good work at the box office and the Golden Globes, and it also inspired one of Metallica's finest songs. 1944 sees Going My Way take all the money and all the Oscars, and one of the finest noirs ever made, Double Indemnity, is released. And that's not bad going, really, is it? 1945 has a Spellbound as Hitchcock releases Spellbound, and a 12-year-old Elizabeth Taylor emerges in National Velvet. She went on to have a quiet career where nothing else interesting happened, didn't she? 1946, and it's that man Jimmy Stewart again, showing us that Christmas doesn't have to be the cynical shambles we all think it is, with It's a Wonderful Life. Attaboy, Clarence. 1947, the United States House of Representatives of the 80th Congress voted 346-17 to approve citations for contempt of Congress against the Hollywood Ten. The Waldorf statement is released by the executives of the United States motion picture industry that marks the beginning of the Hollywood blacklist, and the very first Edinburgh Festival is staged. God blimey, did nothing good happen in 1947? And finally, in 1948, it's a good year for the Brits, as they finally win their first Best Picture Oscar for Hamlet, and Sir Laurence Olivier wins Best Actor. He wasn't too bad at that acting lark, was he? But Smokey, I hear you cry. This is all very well and good, and your voice is so soothing. But what the devil has been happening with Hammer? Oh, okay, you precocious little scamps. I shall tell you. This period of time in Hammer's history is a little bit of bones, to be honest. There was a war on for some of it, after all. But it would be churlish of me to not at least give you the details of just what was occurring. James Carreras joined Exclusive in 1938, closely followed by William Hines' son, Anthony. At the outbreak of the Second World War, James Carreras and Anthony Hines left to join the armed forces, and Exclusive continued to operate in a limited capacity. In 1946, James rejoined the company after demobilisation. He resurrected Hammer as the film production arm of Exclusive, with a view to supplying quota quickies, cheaply made domestic films designed to fill gaps in cinema schedules and support more expensive features, as Al Kev has previously talked to us about. Anthony Hines was convinced to rejoin the company, and a revived Hammer Film Productions set to work on our recently discussed Death in High Heels and The Dark Road. Not being able to afford top stars, Hammer acquired the film rights to BBC radio series such as Dick Barton, yay, Dick, and our forthcoming review, The Adventures of PC-49. All were filmed at Marylebone Studios during 1947, but during the production of Dick Barton Strikes Back in 1948, it became apparent that the company could save money by shooting in country houses and stately homes instead of studios. And that is us pretty much up to date. Hammer is back, up and running, and seemingly hitting the nail on the head. But will it all be plain sailing from here? Or will Hammer once again get that sinking feeling? And that, of course, leads us to River Patrol.
So, as Smokey retires to the green room for a baby sham, you're up to speed. And it's time we shift our attention to today's feature presentation, where we're patrolling the mean post-war rivers of Britain with, well, River Patrol. Released in 1948 and directed by Ben R. Hart, starring John Blythe, Lorna Dean and Wally Patch, the movie follows the brave men and women, well, man and woman in the singular actually, it's not a huge cast, of River Patrol, as they look to bring down the mobsters at the centre of a contraband smuggling and distribution outfit. And what are they smuggling? Drugs? Booze? No, worse. Nylon stockings. And before we get to delve further into those nylons, Kev's going to tell you a little more about the actual River Patrol. Because this film is based on real events, kind of. Like Little Caesar, or The Untouchables, or Masters of the Universe.
Now, I know it might seem incredible, but River Patrol is loosely based on reality, albeit very loosely. Since the 1700s, His or Her Majesty's Customs, in one form or another, have indeed seen their fair share of the action, tackling smugglers right across Britain. I say one form or another because there's been the Water Guard, which became the Coast Guard, that then became confused when airports became a thing. As the name Coast Guard suggests, at this point in Britain's history, customs officers were dotted about the coast, keeping this island safe from pirates, smugglers, and nylons. There wasn't an awful lot of pottering about the Thames in a little boat. That's where the Thames Marine Police come into the picture. They were formed as a private security service to protect the warehouses of the West India Planters Committees and the West India Merchants from those dreaded thieves in the late 1700s. The idea caught on, and when Robert Peel formed the Metropolitan Police 3 decades later, it was made up of Bow Street Runners and the Marine Forces. To this day, the Thames Division of the Metropolitan Police do a lot of pottering about on the river in little boats. So all in all, River Patrol is actually a superstar DJ mashup of two very old British institutions, with a healthy sprinkling of guns and nylons to make it less boring.
So there we have it. Real people stemming the tide of illicit goods. And as I may have mentioned, the goods at the heart of this movie are nylons. And our brave pair of officers pose as a courting couple with underground connections in order to infiltrate the vicious smuggling gang bringing the goods in from France. And boy, was there a demand for what they were smuggling in the 1940s. If oil was black gold, then nylons were transparent brown gold? Sometimes transparent other coloured gold? Yeah, that's not working. Anyway, to tell you more about the post-war nylon trade, here's this idiot. In October 1939, the chemical company DuPont introduced nylon stockings. At the time, stockings could only be found in sheer silk or rayon, which, although luxurious, were far too susceptible to ladders and rips. Nylon was touted for its strength of steel and sheerness, and the women of the United States were hooked.
When a girl changes from bobby socks to stockings.
But alas, the war came. First, silk supply was halted, and with it the supply of silk stockings, pushing up the price of nylons. And then, nylon itself was commandeered for the war effort, with both the nylon and the chemicals involved in its production needed elsewhere. Skip forward a few years, and in post-war Britain, nylons were here, and they were big business for smuggling gangs and black market sellers. Even the abolition of rationing didn't affect it. The shortages persisted. Supplies of fully fashioned stockings of any kind were still well below pre-war levels. With demand massively outstripping supply, what happened was what always happens in such cases, and the nylon racket began. In the United States, there were riots in the mid-40s, owing to nylon shortages. In one of the worst disturbances in Pittsburgh, 40,000 women queued for up to 13,000 pairs of stockings. This led, perhaps somewhat unsurprisingly, to fights breaking out in the street. Back in the UK, supplies were diverted from those originally intended for other markets, or they were simply stolen. It was reported that seconds or export strays could be sold at 50 to 80% marked up prices by spiv traders, so there was real money to be made. In response, little could be done by the authorities. It was difficult to secure any sort of prosecution. The fines were small and the supply chains were almost impossible to trace. The official response seemed to blame the consumer, stating that if women didn't place such importance on nylons, weren't prepared to pay such high prices and reported all overcharging to the authorities, there wouldn't be a nylon black market at all. Seems like a brilliant approach. They should try it with Class A drugs and see how they get on. So, the scene is set. We have the bad guys bringing in the goods, the courageous officers who'll stop at nothing to rid the streets of unlicensed undergarments. The stage is set, the taper is lit, the nylons are stuffed. And to hear what we thought about it, let's head over to Adam, Kev, Smokey, and, sorry, me as well. So lads, River Patrol, murder and crime on Britain's waterways. Smokey, what did you think?
It's a film.
Indeed.
Would you care to expand on that reference, Mr. Commode?
I mean, look, how many films now? So this is episode 7. So we're what?
Nine
films in. So because of the three Dick Barton ones, you cheeky but yeah, it's this is possibly one of the worst. It's alongside Sporting Love and The Dark Road. It's called River Patrol. And is there any patrolling of rivers?
There's plenty of stock footage at the beginning if you look for it.
For about 30 seconds of
they
a
have
3-minute long movie.
There's a lovely boat halfway through the film.
I can't believe this is your complaint. There's not enough a percentage of the film on the river.
I'm just saying, this is the start of my complaint.
It's 43
this isn't
minutes.
My whole complaint.
All you do is basically introduce themselves and it's finished.
Okay.
Adam, you should have heard his review of Star Trek. Oh, God.
Oh, what? They did not trek the stars enough.
No.
They really didn't. No, this is a pretty weak entry in Hammer's canon so far, to my mind. It's rather lifeless and uninspiring and poorly acted and poorly made. And yeah, I was massively disappointed. Back to you, Ben.
I'd say I'm going to sort of disagree with you, which is unusual because we're usually well and truly on the same page.
Yeah.
I watched this twice, and on my second viewing, I found it to be efficient and an interesting look at a certain period of time and the things that went on in those post-war years. It's a very stripped down plot. There ain't no asides or side plots or characters that have something else going
exposition.
On. No, yeah, it's all over and done with in 43 tight minutes.
Oh, thank God.
Tight minutes, you get it?
Oh, dear.
I tried hard there. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, it is what it is. So there's some people smuggling tights, and the good guys have got to stop them doing that, and they do in the space of 43 smooth minutes. What I would say is
smooth
though,
right at the
beginning. It shines through.
Stop being a denier.
You didn't have to explain. We were on a roll there.
Just your eyes all goggled.
I think what I would say about this is, and obviously the listener has heard my introduction to the world of the seedy underworld of nylon in late 1940s Britain. But imagine the guy at the beginning who they make a really big deal out of, who is killed in the worst gunfight ever put on film ever.
It's the most confusing gunfight ever.
Yeah, including a man who's shooting bullets out of his gun by thrusting the gun forward, it's almost as if he's never used a gun before.
It makes the bullet fly faster.
Go faster, yeah. That's
he's rabbit punching the bullets out of his gun. Yeah.
But Maxwell, who we're never introduced to and thus don't care about, is killed horribly, apparently, although we don't see it, in this gunfight. And I just think the irony of at least he died cleaning up the streets from
the
nylons.
Rivers. The rivers.
Oh, yes, look, Britain's waterways from nylons. And look, it does seem a touch absurd some 60 or 70 years later to look back and think, really? That was worth dying on a slow-moving river on a Thursday night? What was it?
Canal boats going past.
When what's his name? Roberts, the ventriloquist dummy. When he actually goes to the office and explains away Maxwell's death, he just goes, "Oh, guns were shot. You know, he got in the way. He died." Shall I go and tell the wife then? Like what?
Yeah, somebody has to. Do I have to? Oh, there is a bizarre sort of medley of shots of him going around telling various people.
This is
a person that the viewer doesn't even know has died.
I couldn't believe how much of the 45 minutes this film takes. I was watching about 15 minutes in, and he got into his like 19th room going, "What's his face is dead," and they all just kind of like look at him and go, "All right, okay." Cheers. And they carry on playing cards or, like, you know, scratching their ass or having a pill, whatever it is. And it's like, is this scene really necessary?
But the best one of those, though, is that he enters the canteen to inform the people in the canteen that this person is dead. And they've got the radio playing.
Yeah.
And he switches it off with a flourish to, you know, make it silent. And just as he's about to say, oh, by the way, this bloke's dead, the score just suddenly kicks in. And so it was silent for about 2 seconds. And it was like, oh, that was dramatic. Oh, no, it's not.
No, there is a running theme score, of the score great. Being somewhat intrusive.
Somewhat?
Somewhat. I couldn't hear half the film. Please turn it down. I actually can't hear what they're saying. And I want to know who he's telling now that Maxwell is dead. At 28 minutes. Sorry. Smoker, I have to disagree with you. This is
okay.
It's an absolute masterpiece, this film.
Wow.
It's a masterpiece.
If only the listeners could see
your face. Masterpiece.
Can you stop
absolutely
holding your crossed fingers up to the camera?
No, 100%. People who know the kinds of films I like will recognise I'm telling the truth. I like the Brighton Strangler, Night as a
yes.
Thousand Eyes. I like the ape and the gorilla. And so when I watched River Patrol, I was like, oh, this is ticking every box and I lunch. And the fact that the pub is the same room that he told someone he was dead in at the beginning of the film. Well, they've yeah. shifted yep. tables around. Yeah. They've drawn some stuff on the wall. They've got literally they've got a bar in the corner of the room and well, it's hard to explain without. It's like a
Del Boy's bar.
Yeah, Del Boy's bar. Exactly. Yeah. It can just about fit one guy and one optic behind it. It's like a pile of old glasses on the. Oh, it's a thing of beauty. I really love this film.
What I like about the pub scene is that they really try to ramp up the horror of nylons, because that's where some drunk guy comes in and he's like got a bundle of nylons, and you'd think he was like, I don't know, cutting a line of crack on a baby's head or something from the way they look at him. And it's like because what we have are these two lead characters, this supposed husband and wife or
Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Indeed. Oh, yeah. Looking at each other with ever widening eyes as these nylons are produced, and you think, I'm not getting it. They're just tights.
Why were nylons so horrifying back then? Yeah. It's like he walks in and he goes, excuse me. What? And he leans over the bar and sort of whispers, no. You know, I get some nylons, and he goes, no, I ain't seen any for ages. Jesus Christ. The tights.
The thing is, right, earlier on, Roberts goes into the office and, well, I say the office, it looks like another part of the canteen. It's really hard to tell what's what in this place anyway. Everywhere's got no windows. But when he goes to see his boss actually says, last week they smuggled in 20,000 pairs. And I was thinking, wait, in that boat? That's bloody good going, that. Well done, lads. But
they don't take up much room, though, Kev.
Yeah, no.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, true. They can squash down.
I reckon you can get 100 pairs in your pocket.
Yeah, I know, but what kind of a business model is this? It seems like a crazy business model where they're trying to keep it so that the
rare... You've analysed the business model.
Kev's going to pull out a balance sheet in a minute, haven't you?
Can we see the PowerPoint now, please, Kev?
I love it. He's gone to the bank and he said, look, I want some funding. Really? What's your business model? Kev's got his whiteboard out. Right.
Now, I can do 20,000 nylons a week.
I'm wearing a pair of combats, I can get 5,000 pairs into the country.
But, I mean, they're flooding the market. They're just going to have no worth whatsoever. Give them a couple of weeks and that's it. That's London sorted for nylon.
I'll tell you something that I did love was a line that... it's fine, let him. When Roberts is going undercover to get in with the heavies.
Brilliant.
And he says, after a brief bit of disguise and body transformation?
Yes.
And all he does is fluffs up his eyebrows and puts some newspaper in his shoulders to give him a heavier build.
Put some beer mats in his coat.
Yeah. And look, he's a completely new man.
Dude, I didn't recognise him.
Who is this man? We haven't seen him on screen before. I love that bit. I've got to admit, that was excellent.
Clouseau's disguises had nothing on him.
Oh my God. It's just a masterpiece.
he heads out to the dodgy East End club or whatever it is as well.
Yeah.
And immediately sort of makes himself familiar with what they're doing by just approaching a table and just starts tossing dice. Well. It's the worst game in the world. I don't know. He doesn't know what's going on. They don't know what's going on. No one knows what's going on apart from the fact they're tossing dice repeatedly.
Yeah. But apparently he's winning at it. I don't know how.
12 quid.
Oh my God, that's 1,200 pairs of tights. I love the fact as well, like, you know, that, you know, got any tights? Shut up, get over there, I'll send someone over this. And yeah, to ingratiate himself with the bad guys, he walks in and goes, want to buy a load of fake booze? Okay, yes, please. Just goes and shoves it all in there. It's like booze was... I can't understand how you can't like this film, Spanky. Oh, my God. And the Matrix fight at the end is just...
Oh, wow.
Hang on. You keep aiming that at me. Am I alone that I dislike this? Am I alone?
I disliked it at first, but I like it very much now.
Yeah.
Kev?
I'm at the other end of the other side of the hill. Right. I've watched this 8 times. And honestly.
See? He must be on our side.
He loves it.
Shh, quick, cut his mic off.
I want to die.
What'd you watch it 8 times for then?
Because I thought there must be something in here that Adam really likes, but I can't see it at all.
so we're split 50-50 then?
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. But, oh, come on, Adam, you've got to admit, this is so badly made.
Yeah.
But he loves it.
Yeah, all right, fine. No. It's like the kids, isn't it? If one of them's badly made, you still love it.
Can we talk about the scene on the boat where there's a deal between our criminal boss.
Yeah. This is Shakespearean.
No, not the French.
It's a scene I've summed up with the chapter title, Ship in a Bottle, Frenchman Throttled.
Oh my God.
That's so why good. You're the secretary. That's all.
At the Café Bleu.
Yeah, the Café Bleu.
So it's obviously French.
How could you tell with his beret? Is that what gives it away?
He has a string of onions around his neck. So they go into this cafe, don't they? Oh, they go across the channel and they pick up a load of tights. And then they say, come onto the boat and we'll pay you. So he goes onto the boat and they just drive away. He says, oh, he let me off this boat. And suddenly the big bad draws out a sword from his cane and shoves it into the guy and kills him. And it's like, I actually cried.
with excitement, no, humour,
joy,
emotion.
At the sheer ridiculousness.
No, just because it really affected me.
Is it because you had onions around your shirt at the time?
That's what it was. I could smell him from here. I could smell him across time.
Yes, the big bad, I would say he's actually quite intimidating. I think he's pretty well cast because he does come across as an East End villain. And I do like the way he dispatches his counterpart by throttling him with a pair of tights, which, irony. And as you say...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's the other guy he stabs with
his sword. It's his henchman he then does with a cane sword.
Yeah, I thought he was a very Robert De Niro-ish, to be honest.
I always thought he was more Lawrence Tierney, that kind of thing, you know, big bad.
I was joking, Kev.
Right.
by the way, we should point out that his sword is apparently made of balsa wood.
in an important scene, the big boss's number two isn't fond of the idea of also being sort of impaled to death by the cane sword, so he snaps it over his knee and throws it out the window.
It's very odd scene.
I didn't know you could do that with swords.
No, I'm not sure you can, technically.
You've just never tried it. That's all.
No, that's true. I haven't. But also, the fact that he wraps his hand around it to snap it over his knee. And it's like, hang on, what have you just done?
There's this huge thing made out of the fact that, you know, the big bad's got a sword and a cane.
Mm.
And then the number two, very conspicuously, waits till the boss is out, takes the sword out and snaps it and throws the blade out and sort of sticks the handle and a tiny bit of the blade back into the cane. And you think that's going to pay off later in the film. And you think, oh, he's going to go to use it and, you know, it's going to save his life and it, you know, it'll be broken. And so, actually, he gets to the end of the film and he does indeed draw his part sword out and go to use it. And instead he goes, oh, that'll do anyway. Just use it anyway. Just stabs the guy.
Check off
any point.
Point. Yeah, I do agree with you, Smokey, and that was a weak moment in the film. But
good. I'll take it up. Oh, okay, I'll take American. That's fine.
Is anybody else mystified by the booze thing that became like a side plot for about 2 minutes, where suddenly our hero is running illicit booze but is actually using real booze that is just happily got from the office, just gone, oh, can I have a couple of cases, and throws a couple of bottles in as well on the side, and then boss is going, right, you are, I think I'll have one too. But yeah, that seems to just dissipate very quickly. We don't never see any payoff for that either, except for the 90 quid or whatever they got for it.
I think that really added to the
It's corruption at the highest
deep,
level
deep
of the
character
government.
Development in the film.
Mm. Or some may say they just didn't think it through properly.
As far as I'm concerned, that just brought the characters even more to life for me.
You dick.
I could reach out and touch them. They were so real. I absolutely love this film. Like, the more you're talking about it as well, the more I'm going, oh yeah, there's that bit as well. It's just awesome.
I think
wants
what
to watch
we should move on
now.
To is the not as many times as you though. I think what we should move on to though is the conclusion of the film, where our hero is rummaging around in the dark and then gets clonked on the head and carted off to a warehouse, only for probably, and I don't want to talk it up too much, the greatest fight in cinematic history.
Thank
ever
you, thank you, occur. Ben. Thank you. I'm so glad. Said I was watching this and I actually ranked my on-screen fights the other day. Number 3, The Quiet Man. Number 2, All the Matrix. Number 1, River Patrol. 1948. 100%. Yeah. Honestly, you've never seen anything like this fight at the end of this film.
True.
It is just mind-blowing. He swings on a rope. He falls off the rope. He smashes his bum into the guy. He falls down the stairs.
While I was watching this fight, all I could think was Dick Barton wouldn't put up with any of this. He would have just dove in and broke it all up and swiftly dealt with it and not rabbit punched the crap out of an East End villain.
You're missing the point here, Smokey.
Nope.
The guy, Robbie, the detective guy, he was using what he had at his disposal. He was in like a bell tower thing and he had a rope. And he went, you know what, I'm going to try this. So the guy's running down the stairs and he goes, you know what, whatever, I'll try this. So he hangs on the rope and sort of doesn't swing down so much, sort of swings across and then goes, oh no, hang on, the guy's like halfway down the stairs. So he has to let go of the rope and sort of catch it and give himself a hand burn and then sort of swing lamely into him and then punches him.
Dick Barton don't need no rope. He just has his fists and that's all he needs.
Did Dick Barton stand on the baddie's hand, causing a close-up to the baddie's face, where he gave an audible sigh?
That was the other way around.
it's a good guy.
Is it the good guy? I couldn't tell. I was too excited.
It's the noise I believe he missed.
Dick Barton would have just filmed the bad guy down the whole bell
Dick
tower
Barton,
anyway.
You're all misremembering. Dick Barton would have been punched in the face about 50 times in the duration of this fight.
But
that's all Dick
won.
Barton did.
He still
would have won, but he would have been punched repeatedly. At least there were some kidney shots in this.
He would have won
to the back of the head.
100%, Ben. 100% right. What I like about this film as well, it's very realistic. If I tried to swing down a bell rope and kick a man, this is exactly what would happen. I'd fall down, I'd burn my hands, I'd fall off the rope,
break your legs.
I'd land on my head, he would stand on my hand and I'd go, ugh. But I would eventually win. And that's
Adam,
what happens.
It's
very realistic.
Adam, I will upgrade my Patreon to see that.
Okay.
It's when he throws a barrel at him like Donkey Kong.
Tin.
That's what I like. Have a barrel! And he misses as well.
He
it's very heavy.
He doesn't throw it. He drops it.
Yeah, have that. Oh, no, you've missed.
More handstandy time, please.
I think my God. The best bit, though, about the whole fight is how it ends. And it's because they've had to edit it out. Because what he actually does, if you watch it really closely, is he puts a pair of brass knuckles on and he hits him repeatedly. Then he takes them off and puts them in his pocket. But they have to edit all of that out. So all it looks like is he summoned up the strength for some kind of super punch that's knocked this guy out. Like something out of Street Fighter 2. And then that's the end of business, exactly.
That is Street Fighter 2 is a very good description of this fight. It's so graceful. Oh, God. I can't wait to see this film again. Part of me didn't want to watch it again because I didn't want my... you know, perfect opinion
wrong.
Of it
yeah.
ruined. I'm not Kev. I can't, you know, take the swing back in there 8 times. I don't want my illusions ruined. But I remember finishing it and I was laying in bed going, oh, I was fizzing with excitement. I couldn't sleep for like 2 weeks. Loved it.
So I'm going to go around each of you in summary, as I think we've talked through quite enough of a 43-minute film. Kev, let's go to you. Concluding thoughts, Kev.
Bad economics. It's just terrible economics. They've just not really thought this through at all.
The business model is just not realistic, is it?
Exactly. It's a hard pass.
Smokey?
Oh, I see. What you're doing is you're getting the two bad ones out of the way and you two are just going to praise it. Is that how you're doing it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sounds like it.
Right. this is dreadful. this is the third worst Hammer film we've watched so far.
Well, that's pretty good. We've only watched 5.
It's practically in the Champions League spot.
So it's top 10 then.
It's not as bad as Sporting Love, and it's not as bad as The Dark Road, but it's the next one up. This is dreadful. The acting performances are terrible. Oh, by the way, we didn't mention two things, actually. One is the really weird plot line that didn't even exist, which is the relationship between Robbie and his female partner, Jean, thank you, who were just partners, i.e. working partners, all the way throughout the film, and then right at the end, he asks her to marry him, yeah. And out of nowhere, she says yes, for inexplicable reasons, because A, as Kev so rightly said, he looks like a ventriloquist puppet, and B, he's a bit of a wet blanket who needs to put newspaper in his arms to make him look big. And of course, the film ends. We didn't mention this. How can we not mention this? How the film ends, gentlemen? With
shocking.
Him breaking the fourth wall, winking at us, and his bandaged hands from the massive windmilling fight that he's had of kidney punches and rabbit punches. He's got the end written on his bandages on his hand.
I thought that was like what hard men do. They like write, you know,
no.
good. And bye on the other fist, and they go, duh, duh. I thought he's like, the end. Like, he goes around beating people up, so the end, like that.
That's Street Fighter 3.
That's the last thing they see.
Left, right, good night. Yeah, no, that's it. And then the other thing, before I just say, have we watched a Hammer film that hasn't had a scene in a pub?
Ooh.
I don't think you ever will, to be honest.
I don't think so. It's weird, isn't it? I just suddenly realised,
yeah.
like, every film we've watched that has a, sorry, quote-unquote pub, because it's just... Del Boy's bar.
Room.
Yeah.
So there we go. No, this is dreadful. Don't watch it.
There's no port on offer on this pub though. It's terrible.
I know. It's horrendous.
Shocking.
No, this is bad, lads. I'm sorry. No, this is bad.
Shut up, Smokey.
I'm editing that out.
Smokey's wrong. It's a masterpiece. How many out of 10 did you give it, Smokey?
4.
I give it 16 out of 10. So there we go. We've got a perfect score there. If you can see the joy and the beauty in a terrible thing, then you will love River Patrol. And I am firmly off.
Oh, shut up.
Excuse me, I let you speak. All right, Mr. I have no class or taste. It's if you can appreciate a good B movie, River Patrol is right up there. You know, it's like he fires at a wall and then it cuts through stock footage, or should I say stocking footage, of the
Ooh.
Bullets flying across the river and making the boat people die. Then we get 20 minutes of the 43, where he's telling people that someone's died. And then you get the most amazing fist fight ever, I think, committed to cinema at the end. It's a masterpiece. It's an absolute masterpiece. It's a masterpiece of bad cinema. 16 out of 10.
Yeah. It...
With no windows anywhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you wouldn't have any windows if someone rabbit fire punching doors a bullet. I love everything about it. I love the suddenly love story. I love the bar. I love the Donkey Kong bit, the swingy bit, the Tarzan fight thing. I love the directorial flair at the end where he zooms in on his face. He stands on his hand and goes, oh. That moment is just beautiful. It's a real joy. It's only 43 minutes. If this film was like 2 hours, 40 minutes, and it was this bad, I'd probably go, oh, no, it's not worth watching for 43 minutes. He snaps a sword. He strangles a guy. He stabs a guy. He swings on a guy. He sells some booze. And as you say, you know, the big bad in it is actually really good. I think it's great. I really like it. It's my favourite Hammer so far.
Well, what more can I add? Other than I'm in complete agreement with Adam.
Yes, River Patrol.
That'll do.
It's absolutely brilliant.
I'm happy to be with Kev on this one. We're staying over here. You stay over there.
So there you have it. A controversial split decision, as painful as a split pair of nylons. Why don't you check out the movie yourself and see what you thought? And if you do, why don't you let us know via Twitter and Instagram, where you can find us at @HouseHammerPod. You could also drop us an email if you want, via scream@houseofhammerpodcast.com. Well, that's almost it for today, but before we go, I'll give you a little hint as to what will be coming up next time. In fact, all I will say is this. It's PC Archibald Barclay Willoughby at the double. And with that, it's goodbye from myself, Ben Taylorson.
From me, Kev.
From me, Smokey.
From me, Adam Roach.
We wish you well until you return again to the House of Hammer.